This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Philadelphia activists hold a two-day conference on the central role of Black working people in reshaping U.S. society. And Haiti is still occupied by foreign soldiers, but its people are in the streets demanding that the U.S.-backed regime step down.
But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is gearing up for its annual march on the White House and conference on November 3rd and 4th in Washington, D.C. This year, the theme is U.S. Out of Africa. Omali Yesha Taylor is chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. He says the U.S. military command and Africa, AFRICOM, is there to prop up foreign economic and social control over the continent. But Yesha Taylor says American global rule is in disarray.
Things are falling apart, but it's an extremely dangerous moment as well, which is one of the things that makes our mobilization so important. And even how we've characterized and titled mobilization, there's no peace, Africa and Africans are at war, U.S. to the world, comply or die. I think it's quite appropriate, looking at what we see, that this chaos, and some of it perhaps even planned chaos, this false debate that's going on between different sectors of the ruling class who are calling themselves Republicans and Democrats as part of a shell game that they play against the mass of the people, with some of them using impoverished and desperate people in order to make their political point, while others are using the same phenomenon to make a point that speaks to reaction and calling on the whole reactionary history and tradition of the United States government and the white population of this country. So you got one sector with a very callous and cynical way of using the poverty, the oppression, even the actions of repressive sector of the bourgeoisie that right now Trump represents the public face of that. So you've got them using those actions to mobilize people or attempt to mobilize people for their own benefit, all of which serves capital and not the people. Then you've got people like Trump and the social base that he represents in terms of reaction, all of them, again, using the people. And that's why the Black is Back Coalition mobilization is so critical at this moment, because it calls on African people to get organized. It calls on Black people to get organized. It calls on us to come to terms with the fact that even when we look at this crisis of imperialism, that there's an escalated aggression that's being made against our people, against the peoples of the world, and even against the ability of the people to protest through the things that are happening to us. So it's a splendid moment. But it's, like I said, it's also a very dangerous moment, a wounded animal. And, you know, has often been described, I think correctly so, as most dangerous. And that's what we're looking at here with the United States government, U.S. imperialism, and in many ways, imperialism in general. But of course, the hegemon is wounded. And that creates an interesting set of dynamics, because everyone who is the friend of the hegemon is not the friend. He has a friend because it's the hegemon, because it's got the guns, because it's got all the money, because it's got all the influence or appears to have. But as you see, this U.S. imperialism showing any evidence of weakness and decay, you will see also, and we are seeing, the emergence of other forces who are willing, even if timidly, to challenge the hegemon for its own space and for its own interest. It's a very interesting and critical moment in history. And the Black is Back, I think, is right on time to be pushing this mobilization. But the truth of the matter is, every time we've come with the annual mobilization, it has been over the last 9 years a period of crisis of imperialism. We recognized it, I think, in the coalition a lot earlier and then some other people, and even saw that crisis being represented in the form of Barack Hussein Obama. And so we've been working on it in that regard. We have a head start on a lot of other forces. But the call, again, is to get people to come to Washington, D.C., to participate in this mobilization, this conference, and to contribute to consolidating the national Black political agenda for self-determination as direction that can be broadly given to the struggle of our people at this time.
Yes, we see these thousands of poor people from Central America, many from Honduras, in a caravan coming up through Mexico, seeking asylum in the United States. And President Trump characterizes these folks of somehow mounting an invasion against the U.S.
Yeah, it's really interesting how these forces have the ability to turn history upside down. And how the people who are indigenous to the Americas coming toward this artificial border that they created, especially with the theft of Mexico, they are the invaders. When the ones who came and took the land, stole the land, pushed people into real desperate straits are now being called the invaders. This is turning history upside down. The crisis that's been imposed on people in Venezuela and again throughout the Americas, you know, the U.S. facilitated the coup, I think it was in Honduras, that contributed to the crisis that we are looking at. It's essentially responsible for most of what we see happening in the Americas. People have been, for years now, trying to overturn the consequences of U.S. imperialism, even in places like Nicaragua, where the U.S. puppet regime of Somoza was in power until 1979, and the Sandinistas, the people in Nicaragua, had the audacity to kick them out and try to seize control of their own country, their own resources, their own dignity, their own sovereignty, only to be bombed and murdered by the Reagan administration. All of this stuff happened. It has contributed to this chaos, and people have been struggling to try and to get their own footing for years and years now. And that's a part of what we see the U.S. trying to make sure that they are not able to stand on their own feet, that they cannot achieve control of their own resources. And so they become the enemy. And the objective of the Trump administration, of course, is to convince all the scary white people in this country, which is mean all the white people in this country, that somehow they're being invaded by these poor, starving people who might be from the Middle East or they might be from some other place. They're criminals and murderers and what have you. I mean, Glenn, what is so striking, if you look at the history of this area, if you look at the history of the Americas and where the criminals and the murderers came from and established the existing borders that we're looking at in the Americas, has made this setup, brought slavery of the indigenous people, slavery of African people, and the people, again, have been struggling for years and years. People, some of those people are coming from Guatemala. I heard there's a new caravan that might be coming from Guatemala. And I remember, I think it was 1954, when the U.S. government overthrew the Arbenz government because the people simply didn't want to keep growing bananas for United Fruit Company. And people have been struggling, trying to take control of their own lives, their own resources. And the U.S. has been the enemy of that, just as it has been the enemy of our people in the United States and other places around the world. And this is what we are confronted with. That's why I think it's absolutely correct the title of this mobilization that we're doing November 3rd and 4th in Washington, D.C. There is no peace. Africa and Africans are at war. And the war has been going on, obviously, for a very, very, very long time. It is crystallizing in a fashion that makes it, I think, a little bit easier for us to organize and identify speeches today. And then we're saying that U.S. to the world, come fly or die. And that's the option that the United States is giving to the peoples of the world. And the coalition, I think, is right on time in trying to at least create this forum, a genuine forum for self-determination, saying to our people that self-determination is the highest expression of democracy. We must fight for that. We must reclaim our ability to be a self-determining people. And this is a part of the process that we are fighting for. And that's what people throughout the Americas are fighting for. That's what the people in the caravan, when they are moving in the direction of North America, it is not because of some romantic idea of let's go integrate. It is the fact is whether people are conscious of it or not, they are chasing their own resources. The Americas have been looted and looted and looted for so long. That's why We have things that's called banana republics. That's why the U.S. was able to talk about the Americas and the Caribbean as the backyard of the United States, because there's been a whole history of looting of people and their lands. And now those resources have made America rich, has made the U.S. rich, allows them to have computers and paved streets and clean water and other things like that. And when those people are leaving the places of desperation, they are desperate now because there were riches there, wealth there, that the United States wanted, came, looted, and now people are chasing their own resources. And although they might call those resources a job, or they might call it stability or something to that effect, it's their resources that they are following when they come to this border of North America, this false border, this artificial border, this border that was created in order to separate the people from themselves and their stolen resources.
Democrats try to draw a straight line between Donald Trump and themselves, but of course, it was Barack Obama who signed the executive order that declared Venezuela to be a top national security threat to the United States. And it was President Obama who sanctioned the coup in Honduras under his watch.
It was Obama, and I'm tempted to call it hypocrisy, but it was Obama. And it was Obama who did this incredible escalation of kicking of people, of Mexicans, and out of this country, you know, more than any president had ever done before. Obama did that. And so that's part of what I mean. There's this very cynical game that's being played at the expense of all the people. And on the one hand, you have the Republicans who are relatively open and naked under the leadership of Donald Trump in the aggression and even the self-characterization of being nationalist, white nationalist, in its efforts. And that's what it is, white nationalism. But the Democratic Party is a white nationalist party. And they have black white nationalists like Obama. They have Mexican white nationalists. They have all kinds of white nationalists carrying out the role of working in the employ of white nationalist imperialism. All of them do the same thing, and it's very cynical. And the people are being led into this Democratic Party versus the Republican Party, which are just the ruling class calling itself by different names and keeping the people trapped in this artificial choices. That's why the work that the coalition is doing is critical. It's the most critical work that I can see, because we are not playing that game. And we are not even telling people to be Democrats, Republicans, green, or anything else. We say people can be green, people can be all these things, but our willingness and ability to take a stand as it relates to them depends on their willingness and ability to concretely take a stance in relationship to the demands of the people that's represented in the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. So if a Green can do that, if a Democrat can do that, and if they actually carry that out. But it's not the Democrats or the Greens or the Republicans or anything that we call on people to unite. We're calling on people to be united with their own interests. And that, for our people, is in self-determination. And that's what the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination is all about. Our relationship is for self-determination. We're not getting in bed with anybody just because they are flashy and wear fishnet stockings and stiletto heels. The question is whether or not they can unite with the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. That's what we are calling for. That's what this mobilization on November 3rd and 4th is calling for, helping the masses of our people recognize our interest in self-determination and helping to bring enough information and unity so that people can begin to fight for that, and to fight for that, whether it's against Obama's manifestation of imperialism through somebody like Obama or through somebody like Donald Trump. And I think we've taken the BS out of it. We've taken the romance out of the Democratic Party, and we've asked our people to recognize concretely, materially, what is affecting us. We're saying that Africa and African people are at war, and that there's war that's being made against us. It's made manifest a thousand different ways all the time in this country, around the world, and that we are in solidarity with all the other peoples to whom U.S. is saying comply or die. We're in this thing together, and we are taking a stance that we think is really important, because if we don't say U.S. out of Africa, if we don't say down with AFRICOM, if we don't say that we are supporting all of the movements of African people on the continent to destroy imperialism, even when it comes in disguise, then who will do it? And that's what the Black is Black Coalition is all about. We will represent the black people of the world, and we will do that in solidarity with all the other oppressed peoples around the world and in this country.
And even as war is made against African people in Africa, in Latin America, and in the United States, we have a congressional black caucus that votes in favor of Donald Trump's military budget.
You know, I want to say it's extraordinary, but you know it's not extraordinary. You know, part of what we're looking at is the consequence of the war that's being made against African people. Because when we say war is being made against African people, we're not talking about the Congressional Black Caucus. We're talking about those people who are subject to the whims of the Black Congressional Caucus, because the United States government destroyed the revolutionary movement in this country, destroyed revolutionary leaders, assassinated people, put people in prison, chased them out of the country, and then left in place this farce that's now called the Black Congressional Caucus. That caucus, we don't know what the caucus about, but it certainly is not in the interest of our people. And we're not able to protest even what they now refer to as the militarization of the police that's gunning our people down throughout this country. The Democratic Party, Clinton administration, who put 100,000 cops in the streets, one of whom probably was responsible for killing Mike Brown, for killing Tamir Rice and all these other people. We have not been able to hold them accountable. And in fact, not only did we not hold them accountable, we called Clinton the first black president, and then we got this other guy, Barack Hussein Obama, who was a little less blacker, and then made him the new first black president. So we've been duped. We've been had. We've been misled. And as Malcolm X, you know, might have said, and that's why it's so important for us to call the question, and that we have no loyalties here in terms of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, or any others, that we went through, a really significant process of winning and uniting the people around our own program. And this is what we have loyalty to. And that's that national black political agenda for self-determination. It's never been done before, certainly not in the fashion that we did it. And this is something that we have to promote. And I think we have to use November 3rd and 4th mobilization, the rally, the march on the White House, and the conference that happens on the 4th to really reinforce the significance of the national black political agenda. Because right now, the issue of self-determination is the most important thing that we can press. Given the fact that every day, I mean, when Trump says he is a white nationalist, he's not some fool. He's articulating the feelings and emotions and a nationalism that's deeply embedded in what's called his base. And this base is getting larger, it seems, as we move toward more reaction. So they're talking about 47%. He's polling at 47%. Among the people in this country. Those are white people. And so they have their nationalism. And what has to happen is the revolutionary nationalism among the oppressed people, the demand for self-determination, is something that we have to project as loudly as we can, as boldly as we can, in this opposition to reactionary white nationalism that's coming from U.S. imperialism in a state of decline and despair and crisis. I think that's what it is that our mobilization is going to do, our conference is going to do on November 3rd and November 4th.
And that white nationalism is manifested not just in terms of the police presence in our community, whatever the color of the police, but also the Democratic Party.
Also the Democratic Party. And it's really interesting. You know, we remember the election of George W. Bush, and it was always striking how Albert Gore, who lost that election and would have preferred to concede the election rather than raising the question of even the Voting Rights Act as depriving black people the right to vote. He couldn't even raise that question. That never became the question for the Democratic Party under Gore or anybody else. We're looking at the same organization with different fronts. We're looking at the same white ruling class calling themselves by different names. And I think it's important for us to understand that American imperialism is American imperialism, whether it comes in a black face or white face or any other face that it becomes necessary at any given moment for it to present itself as.
Yes, and we should remind folks that Hillary Clinton had to be dragged into a recount of the vote in Michigan by Jill Stein of the Green Party in terms of challenging that vote when it was very clear that it was black voter suppression that gave that state to Donald Trump. And yet the Democrats did not want to protest.
Yes, And it's interesting because both the Republicans and the Democrats unite that the black vote should not belong to black people. And that's what we were looking at, that we should not be self-determining, that they, either for whatever purposes that they have, they should control the black vote. And that's one of the reasons why, even at the height of the black liberation movement in this country in the 1960s, they would pass a Voting Rights Act and then kill off the revolutionaries so that the politics that we stood for leading into the 1960s, leading and made the Voting Rights Act necessary, the politics that we stood for had no way of expressing itself except through the Democratic Party, because they killed Malcolm, they killed King, they killed the Black Panther Party, attacked every manifestation of self-determination that existed in our community. Now they say, you're free, you can vote. But the only thing you can vote for is the Democratic Party, and that was snatching the ability to be a self-determining people right out of our hands. And so the Democrats and the Republicans, they unite in one thing, that black people should not control our own vote. We should not be in control of our own destiny. It's either going to be in the control of those people who call themselves Republicans and those sections of the white ruling class that call themselves Democrats, not supposed to be us. And the suppression of the vote, the reality is, Malcolm X talked about a long time ago that we decide who goes to the White House and who goes to the doghouse. And the Democrats are united with the Republicans in the assumption that we are not supposed to have that decision-making capacity. They will have that decision-making capacity.
That was Somali Yeshe Taylor, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Louis, Missouri.
In Philadelphia, activists are gearing up for an examination of the role of the black worker. The two-day event, November 8th and 9th, is part of a year-long celebration of the life and work of W.E.B. Du Bois. Dr. Anthony Montero is a Du Boisian scholar and activist with the Philadelphia Free School, the organizers of the Focus on Black Workers.
This year is the year of Du Bois in Philadelphia. It is Du Bois's 150th birth anniversary. And one of the foundational concerns of Du Bois is the black worker, and especially in his great work, Black Reconstruction in America, it begins with the black worker. And so this conference is one of about seven or eight conferences and symposia that we have held this year. And this, we think, will be one of the high points because it is an attempt to deal with the peculiarities of the class conflict in the United States. And frankly, how do we locate class agency, working class agency in this time? And so we take a Du Boisian approach and say that the central agency of class consciousness and class leadership is to be found among black workers.
Well, you know, we've heard a lot about the working class, more than we usually hear about the working class in the United States. But most of it, since the election, has concerned the white working class and not specifically black folks.
Absolutely. And of course, that is not unusual in a country that privileges whiteness, and so doing obscures the essence of what class is. In other words, class cannot be separated from race, slavery, racial oppression. And in that sense, the working class is not constituted as a single entity. As such, it is made up of components who experience class exploitation and oppression differently. And so the black worker, the most oppressed, the most exploited, and historically the most class conscious, plays a unique and peculiar role in the history of the United States and in the history of the working class in this country. The other side of it is, and this is very Du Boisian, the black worker is connected in unique ways to the workers of Asia and Africa and South America. That is the colonized majority of the world. And when I say colonized, I'm not only talking about classic colonialism, but also neo-colonized labor.
And again, when we talk about the working class, most of the conversation, at least implicitly, seems to refer to males. But studies have shown that the group in the United States that most favors unions is Black women.
Absolutely. And that's what we are also profoundly interested in. To put it in a very graphic sense, we're interested in that woman who gets up at 4:30 in the morning to be at a job that begins at 6:30 and often does not make enough money to pay her rent and feed her children and herself. That hero of the working class who nobody knows her name is really the specific force within even the Black working class that we are especially interested in. And indeed, not only are they invisible to most people, including most workers, unfortunately, but they are the most militant, the most far-sighted, and actually the most organized and open to class organization.
And again, when people in the United States talk about the working class, most often the picture that they conjure up is a white man in a hard hat, which harkens back to the days back in the 1960s when the hard hats were famous for attacking anti-war demonstrators. But the Black working class, like Black people in general, is the most anti-war and pro-peace cohort in the United States.
And, you know, I agree with you completely, but also that force in the society in general that has been most open to anti-imperialist solidarity. In other words, you mentioned anti-war, so that takes us back to the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam. Black workers, young Black workers, males at that time, went to fight, die, and be traumatized in Vietnam in disproportionate numbers. But when they came back, they brought not only a sense of their own victimization by U.S. imperialism, but they brought back a sense that the Vietnamese peasants and workers fighting for freedom were very much like them. I think that is the case today when the U.S. Armed Forces are gender integrated and, you know, story after story of Black women who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan coming back to the United States testifying that the Iraqis and the Afghanis were more like them than they, Black women workers, were like the white males who were commanding them. So I think this consciousness, this understanding, this identity with world humanity and with the working class of the colonized and neo-colonized majority of the world brings a specific and unique consciousness by Black women workers, by Black workers in general, to the table. And for our part, we think that a big task at this time is the political education of the Black working class and unleashing their profound revolutionary potential.
And this event that you have scheduled for November, I understand, is part of that political education.
No question about it, as has been the entire year of Du Bois. We feel that at the center of the struggle at this time is the ideological struggle, and to engage the masses of people in the ideological struggle requires political education. And from our standpoint, the political education of the Black working class. You know, I must say that our experience in this year has shown us that Black working people are very much open to advanced ideas and are very prepared to engage in the struggle of ideas as a part of the struggle of resistance to monopoly capitalism.
Most certainly, this environment in which people are urged to see Russians under every bed and in any closet is a hostile environment to any talk of peace.
Definitely it is. But what we have begun to see, because we've had, you know, several conferences and activities centering around either Blessed Are the Peacemakers or questions of women and the fight for peace or unity of Pan-Africa and Pan-Asia. You know, all of these topics have gotten a really great response from the people of Philadelphia. Now, of course, saying that is to offer a critique of the standard left, the so-called left in this country, which thinks that all you have to have are slogans and action, so-called, and that's the end of it. And what happens is that the sloganizers and those who are just the proponents of action, what ends up happening is that the masses of people are not drawn to either their slogans or their actions because they are also interested in what are the ideas that are driving the actions that you're calling upon us to enter in. I think in a big sense, people understand this whole idea that ideas are powerful and that to change the world, you have to understand it. To understand the world, in order to change it, you have to locate the critical agents of social and economic change. And that's what we've been about this whole year. And this conference coming up on November 8th and 9th is a high point of all of our work for this year.
And where's the conference going to be located?
It's going to be held at the headquarters of 1199 C here in Philadelphia, which is on Locust Street in the 1300 block of Locust Street in Philadelphia. It'll be held in the evening on that 8th and 9th, a Thursday and Friday, from 5 to 9. And we begin it with Paul Robeson and Martin Luther King Jr. and the fight for the working class. Both of these men were tribunes of working people and of Black working people. And we're going to have the president of 1199C here in Philadelphia, Henry Nicholas, the executive vice president of the Teamsters, that section of it, which organizes the railway workers, and a longtime rank and file activist in the teachers union, Catherine Blunt. By the way, the gentleman from the Teamsters is named Jed Dodd.
Well, you'll be talking about Black labor, but lots of folks, all they want to talk about is the election.
And, you know, the interesting thing is the majority of Black workers will not even take part in the election, at least here in Philadelphia. And what we have seen, interestingly, unlike other election cycles, labor, Black or white, is not that active in getting out the vote, as it were, which means that there is a great questioning of the Democratic and Republican parties. And it seems to me that we might be on the cusp of a major breakaway from the Democratic Party on the part of labor in general, but Black labor in particular, and perhaps Black labor leading the way to the formation of a third party, a labor party that fights for the interest of workers, not mediated by the interest of big capital, by finance and their representatives. And this might be the beginning of a historic moment, and therefore to investigate the historic role of Black labor might be decisive at this time when labor seems to be finding its own voice and its own way in the struggle for its political rights as well as its economic and social interest.
That was Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Monteiro speaking from Philadelphia.
The people of Haiti took to the streets this month to protest government corruption and massive hikes in the price of fuel. In New York City, members of the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti have been protesting outside the Haitian consulate every Thursday, denouncing the Haitian government as a puppet of the United States. Committee spokesperson Daoud André says Haitians want an end to the regime.
Just like what happened after the uprising of our people on July 6th and 7th and 8th of this year, Jovenel Moïse and his handlers, they were forced to roll back the price hikes on the fuel, and they had to get rid of their prime minister, Jacques-Guy Lafontaine. So it's the same situation again, where last week on October 17th, the 212th anniversary of the assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the founder of our nation, estimates are that more than 1 million people came out in protests throughout the country, not just in Port-au-Prince, but throughout the country, to not just demand accountability for the Petro-Caribe money. That's the current wave that we are riding right now. A couple of months now, people are asking what happened to about $4 billion of Petro-Caribe money, that this is the agreement between Hugo Chavez and the government of Haiti, as well as other governments in Central South America and the Caribbean, to allow these countries to buy fuel from Venezuela at preferential prices. And even those preferential prices, the percentage had to be paid up front, and the balance was turned into a 25-year loan at 1% interest. So these countries, like Haiti, could use this money to develop the country, to create another reality for the people of these countries. And from 2008 to up to the earthquake, Venezuela had basically canceled the loan up to the earthquake. So the money we're talking about now is from 2010 to 2018, about $4 billion that disappeared in the thin air. You know, no bid contracts given to cronies, inflated prices for contracts that were the kind of way that crooks in government try to steal money, what they do to steal money. So there's been large protests online, on the internet, social media, and in the streets, people demanding what happened to this money. So the protests on October 17th were to deal with what happened to the Petro-Caribe money, but as well to say that Jovenel Moïse has lost all credibility and that he must go. To pacify the population, the same Jovenel Moïse who last year had said that he's not going to persecute anyone for the Petro-Caribe money, now he's eager to clear the air, to have a trial. And at his speech on October 17th in the city of Dessalines, this was the Haiti's first capital. This is where the government goes every year on that date to have their formal ceremony. In his speech, he said, no one is above the law, and anyone who's associated with this money will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Well, people laughed, you know, because Jovenel Moïse stole some of this money as well. Jovenel Moïse to make him look like he was a successful banana planter, entrepreneur. Michel Martelly had given him some government land that peasants, people were living on the land, gave him the land to do this, and then gave him about, this is a $16 million project, $16 million, most of it government money, that was Petrocaribe money, that was put into this project for a prop, basically what the Hollywood people do when they're doing a film. And by the time it was to inaugurate Jovenel as president, this banana plantation did not exist anymore. So imagine in a country like Haiti, with the poverty, with the needs of the country, no hospitals for the people, and you take $16 million to blow it on a prop. So, you know, you can appear to be a farmer, a large-scale farmer, and to get this election. Of course, this is not what got Jovenel into the palace, National Palace of Haiti. It was the fraud sanctioned by the enemies of Haiti, the United States, Canada, France, that got him there. But no one in their right mind believes that Jovenel Moïse can lead trial of the Petrocaribe thieves. The question was about, you said two people, but he actually, quote unquote, fired 18 people, Glenn, 18 high functionaries of his government that in a decree said that these people are no longer working for the government of Haiti, that they are to be made available to the justice system so that as they had control over Petrocaribe funds and their names are being cited in the streets as people involved in the Petrocaribe money, Jovenel basically said, you know, they are no longer functionaries of the government. And so it's like they have no immunity, that there is no concern but for the justice system to deal with them. But what people in the streets of Haiti are asking, Glenn, is why didn't Jovenel fire himself at the same time? Because he, as well, he has Petrocaribe money that he had control of. So this is a farce, and this supposed firing of these people. But the struggle of the people will continue. And what we are calling for, the cry on the street, is for Xavier Chaudier. This is in Creole. It means to turn the pot over and to break the pot, meaning that the entire system, the rotten system that, you know, creates this reality where Haitians are scattered to the four winds in every country you can think of, in Chile, in Brazil, Argentina, the Bahamas, Dominican Republic. They are treating Haitians, children of Haitians, like dogs. This is the reality that we are looking to change so that Haitians can imagine a future. Young Haitians can imagine a future in their country. And those of us who are living outside of the country can imagine a reality where we go back to build something.
It does appear to an outside observer that ever since the United States overthrew the elected government in Haiti of Jean-Bertrand Aristide back in 2004, that Haitian governments have been a succession of criminal enterprises, and that it has been Venezuela through the Petro program that you were speaking of that has propped up the Haitian economy, and the Cubans whose doctors have served the poor in Haiti.
And of course, we have to add the diaspora, the remittances from the Haitian diaspora in the United States and Canada, all over the world, you know. For the population of Haiti, I think it's it was in the top five countries with their people from the country sending money back to the country, but I'm not sure right now if it's not in the top 10 by proportion. But the reality is that Mr. Trump is alleged to have called it a show. But this reality, this is what the enemies of our people, they want. And this is why they keep on shoving crooks, criminals like Michel Martelly down the throats of our people, knowing full well that these people, they're going to continue these policies that create this reality where Haitians cannot live in the country. This a reality where factory workers are getting something like $3.50 per day. You know, you said since 2004, but in actuality, Glenn, we have to go back much further. In my radio program yesterday, we were speaking to an economist, Fried Jean, and it's a funny story because he comes from the same area where Jovenel Moïse and Martelly had set up this banana plantation. And since June, he has been speaking, giving out the country some numbers about this scam, this banana plantation scam. Like, they spent $16 million to do this thing, and the only money that came out of it was $10,000 worth of bananas that were shipped to Germany. And this boat that came to bring the $10,000 worth of bananas to Germany, Agritrans, Jovenel's company, paid $25,000 for this boat to come to Haiti, pick up $10,000 worth of bananas, and send it over there. And actually, in September, a death squad of PHTK, this is the party of Martelly and Jovenel Moïse, went to his house, Fried Jean, to assassinate him. And he is only alive today because he was not at home when they came, but they ransacked the house. They found a young man who was like a caretaker at the house. They beat him mercilessly, left him half dead. And this is the reality that happens in the country. And Fried Jean has been speaking about this. And it doesn't make any, you know, no waves in the international press, no waves even in the major local press in Haiti. It came out one day and that's it. And this reality is not since 2004, really. This is basically since the first U.S. occupation of our country in 1915, when the United States took control of the finances of the country, pegged our money to the dollar, and created the Gendarmerie d'Haïti, which became the Haitian army, that became a tool of the Duvaliers, along with the Makouts that they created as their personal army. And this is what created this reality that the people see today. Like I said, the, you know, young Haitians, they're getting at a point where they're like, you know, we cannot simply just trying to get out of the country. We have to fight. And this is the movement we are in right now, where people are in the streets. This week after the 17th, the movement took another turn where you have young people in the streets all night long. So there are protests during the day and there are protests at night. They call them Tetro Bizango, and just people demanding that the government leaves, that this reality that we know, it cannot continue.
And of course, there has been resistance all along, as you have said, both before and after 2004. But this time, you think that the resistance has momentum and legs?
Well, we decided since April that we have to do our part in terms of protesting. So since April, we've been here in front of the Haitian consulate at 2nd Avenue between 43rd and 44th in Manhattan every Thursday. And as a matter of fact, right before you called, a man who was coming from the consulate, he stopped. We have a lot of placards and we're giving out literature. And he stopped and he was just looking at them, a Haitian gentleman. And he asked me, you know, why do you guys do this? Do you think this really contributes to what's going on in Haiti? And I explained to him that basically this is what Malcolm had said. You know, we belong in Africa, but we need to fight wherever we are until we get to Africa. And this is what we're doing over here. We are educating people who are passing by. It's like, this is near the United Nations. This is commercial area of Manhattan. So thousands of people. Every week we give something like 300 to 500 flyers in this 3-hour time slot to let people know that, you know, yeah, Trump is a racist pig or, you know, whatever people want to call him. But the reality that Haiti and all of these countries are going through, this is the product of Democratic and Republican administrations. And on the ground, as a matter of fact, we have signs with flags of different countries in Africa, in Central America, in Latin America, the Caribbean, all of these countries. So we have the flag of the Congo turned into a show by Belgium and the United States. You know, in Nicaragua turned into a show by Spain and the United States. So we don't want people living in this country to feel that what's happening in countries like Haiti, and yeah, the show reality that exists in our countries, that this is because we are not smart people, we are not hard workers, you understand? That we don't know what to do, that we need a white man, a white savior, you know, to guide us. No, this reality is the product of the pillage and the plunder of the colonial countries. It's because of slavery. And what we always tell people is that the same countries that were running the slave trade, they're the ones today running the United Nations. You know, they're the Security Council, with the exception of one or two. But so why would people imagine that the interests of these countries have not changed? Just like they were looking to steal labor, to steal resources back then, it's the same thing they're doing today. And they're using, you know, their weapons, nuclear weapons, whatever they have. They're using the media, the propaganda to turn people into zombies, basically. This is what you have. And we continue to have signs asking that the Clintons give back the billions that they stole from Haiti, that the Clintons, the family, Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea, they belong in jail. Yeah. And the fact that Donald Trump has not gone ahead and shut down the Clinton Foundation or to jail Hillary, as he was, we now know, jokingly saying during the campaign, it just shows, you know, they are friends. The real collusion is between the Democrats and the Republicans against the people of the United States and the people of the world, you know.
So the Haitian president has made some sacrificial lambs in terms of the latest scandal, but that's not enough to stop this movement, is it?
No, and this is a farce. This is just the opposite of what he had said he was not going to do the day before. So we want people to understand that a lot of people don't know, but he is actually under indictment. While he was a candidate, he was under indictment because the body, it's kind of like an anti-corruption body that exists in the country. It's called ICRES. They put an indictment on him because he was selling water, basically, before he got into this banana business. He was selling water in a small town of Port-au-Prince, which, by the way, is the town that was the city that was largely affected by the last, I think, October 6th earthquake. But imagine you're selling water in a city that has maybe 200,000 people, you know? And he had 14 bank accounts and depositing 3 million today, 2 million the next day. And people are like, how much water can 200,000 people drink for him to make all of this money? And of course, what he was doing is basically he was money laundering, drug money, because this is a coastal town where a lot of drugs come through. So in Haiti, the nickname that the people of Haiti give to Jovenel Moïse, the fake president, is the inculpé, which means the indicted one. He has no legitimacy. And people tell you that when this guy tells you, you know, good morning, you can know that it's nighttime outside. It's like the Creole expression is bonjour li pa la vérité. Even like when he say good morning, it's not the truth. Everything that comes out of his mouth is a lie.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.